as we wait for the appearance of the King. That's the subject I want to pick up on from our reading tonight. I don't know if you see the obvious connection, but hopefully I'll be able to draw it out for you as we spend a bit of time looking at this passage. So the first thing that I really want to bring out for us about how to wait for the appearance of the Lord, the first thing is, while we wait, make no truce with the devil. While we wait, make no truce with the devil. If there's any area of truce, let's break it off. We're not supposed to be in truce with the devil, first thing. Second thing's this. Having no truce with the devil, let us follow him into spiritual conflict. Spiritual conflict is something the Lord would lead his people into. No truce with the devil, let him lead us into spiritual conflict. Doesn't sound very appetizing, but I do believe this proceeds out from this passage and we should hear it. Second, third point then, when he comes, when the King comes, how do you want him to find you? Do you want him to find you in the battle or in the fort? Where do you want to be found when the King appears? In the battle or in the fort? All right, those are my 3 points. And let me just open this passage up. So just to begin with then, for those of you who have been following through this series in the book of Judges, it may not be apparent or particularly obvious to you. I don't know how closely you read this book or have read this book or read books about this book, but there are parts of this book that the events that you're reading about are also described from another perspective in other books of the Bible. And there's a very obvious book that is set during the time of the Judges. Perhaps the Bible scholars amongst you will realize that, for example, the book of Ruth. Those of you who know the book of Ruth, it says, and these things took place in the times of the judges. So you've got the book of Judges, and then there's also the events. Then those events are not mentioned in the book of Judges, but they're happening at the same time. Now there's another book that coincides, is happening at the same time as what we're reading in the book of Judges, and in particular it's happening at the same time as the events of the life of Samson. So the things we're reading about, there's another book that is referring to this same period of time, but seeing it from a different perspective. And that perspective, in this particular question, is the first book of Samuel. Now what happens at the beginning of the first book of Samuel is this, that we meet Israel in a time of oppression by the Philistines. The Philistines are oppressing the land of Israel. The Philistines have come from the sea in their ships. They've landed at the coastlands. And at the coast there, they've set up their camp, and gradually a very aggressive and a very clever people, actually, very capable people, are gradually moving out and strengthening their position. And the Israelites are being driven back bit by bit. Now, in the first book of Samuel, what happens is that the children of Israel come together. It's in the time there was a man by the name of Eli, who was the high priest. He had 2 sons. He was a good priest, I think, in many ways, but his sons were very indisciplined. There's a lot of corruption at that time. And taking counsel together, they decided that they would raise an army, bring all the Israelites together, and push back against the Philistines. We're going to get them out of our country. And they decided, you know, you heard the expression, you know, throwing everything at it, even the kitchen sink. You know, when people just throw everything at it. In their folly, in their foolishness, they decided the Ark of the Covenant, which is the box that was inside the center of the tent where the children of Israel came to meet and worship God. And inside there, this golden box, which kept the Ten Commandments on the inside of it. They decided its place, it belonged inside this place of worship. They decided to take it out of there, even though God didn't show them, take it out of there and carry it into the battle. As if somehow they were trying to get some added blessing or some added strength or some added help to help them beat the Philistines. But it went terribly, terribly wrong. Not only were they utterly defeated by the Philistines, completely defeated, Eli's 2 sons were killed in the battle. More than that, when Eli heard the news that his sons were dead and the battle had been lost, he fell off his chair and broke his neck and died. And the Philistines captured the Ark of the Lord. The most precious object in the center of their worship was now in Philistia amongst the Philistines, and they were rejoicing. A terrible, terrible time of defeat. And all those events are happening during the days of Samson. Okay? But that isn't the whole story. That's not all that was happening during Samson's life, this time of terrible defeat. God was working in those days too. So the Ark of the Covenant goes down into the temple of the Philistines. They put it there and rejoice. And some of you, I know you children, you probably know the story quite well, that the Philistines had nothing but trouble as long as that the Ark of the Covenant was in their temple. Every time they come in the morning, their statues were all found falling over on the floor and stuff like that. And eventually they realized that they had to give the Ark of the Covenant back. None of the Israelites were able to recover it. God himself, that's the point, God himself made sure the Ark of the Covenant was brought back to Israel. Okay, and the Philistines just gave it up again. And it wasn't just that that was going on. Because in the days of Eli and so on, there was a little boy. And that little boy had been given to the temple, to grow up in the temple, to learn about the things of God. And that little boy was called Samuel. Now, if you remember, some remarkable events happened in the life of Samuel at the beginning. When his mother couldn't have children. And she prayed, didn't she? She went to the temple at the time when Eli was the high priest and prayed that God would bless her and give her a child. And if God would give her a child, she would give that child back to God. And miraculously and wonderfully, the Lord blessed Hannah and gave her this little boy, Samuel, and Samuel was given to the temple. And while he was in the temple there in the days of Eli, he started to hear the voice of God calling him. And God raised up Samuel the prophet. And there had been prophets before in Israel. But this was what the remarkable thing, and this is the exciting thing about the arrival of Samuel on the scene, in the days in which Samson is living, is that Samuel's work, the job that God had him to do, was to anoint God's first king. You know, the whole of the book of Judges, I've been saying to you that this book, I've given the title, Your Kingdom Come. There's this hope, this waiting, this yearning to see the king. And Samuel is the man who's going to spot the king in the crowd and say, you are the anointed. He's the one who's going to anoint David. What I'm saying to you is this. Though they were living in times of defeat and oppression, the kingdom was coming and getting nearer. Can you see the point I'm getting across? Thanks for nodding. I appreciate it. That's good. So life was tough for the Israelites, but God was at work. Okay, and the daylight was appearing. It was dark, but the day was coming. It's like a dawn in the morning. If you ever come early, the sunlight of the new day is just coming. And it's in that time when all these things are happening in the background that we read about in the book of Judges, in the foreground in the book of Judges, about what happens to this other person who's been born. A miracle, a wonderful birth. A child whose mother can't have children, and God comes in power. She's able to give birth, and this child is born. This one not to be a prophet, but to be a savior and a deliverer. God is at work. Even though the days are dark, God is at work. And perhaps you feel that in some regard you live in dark days. You perhaps feel that somehow the cause of Christ is somewhat living under oppression. Perhaps you feel that our message doesn't get out and get heard. But you also know, don't you, that God is at work. You've seen that God is at work, haven't you? And you know that the king is coming, don't you? And so in our days, though it may seem dark, we should remain excited about the prospect. We are going to see the king. So how shall we wait in these dark days for the appearance of the king? And I think this book really helps us to think about that. In fact, when the Ark of the Covenant came back from the Philistines, it came back on a cart. And what they did is they put the box on this cart and put two oxen in front of it, and they literally kind of slapped them on the backside and sent it off just to walk, and the oxen were going to just walk wherever they went, and wherever it stopped, it stopped. It stopped 3 miles up the road from where Samson was born and grew up. In short, just imagine what 3 miles away, right? Is that Southwick, broadly? 3 miles, Southwick? What do you reckon, Chris? I'm looking at you. You're the Southwick man here. No? Bit further. Yeah. But imagine if the Ark of the Covenant had been brought back and was literally up the road. There's that sense that God, the sovereign God, is at work and he's working in our lives. He's near us. They have hope, don't they? There's a people with hope, even in dark days. That's what we find at the beginning of this passage. The birth of Samson, the birth of Samuel as well. And here we are in the book of Judges, and our focus is on Samson. But don't forget that sometimes you can't see it, or you're not even focusing on it, but in the background, God is at work. And I hope I've drawn those connections together, because the whole of the Bible is what we're here to read, isn't it? The whole counsel of God, and although we may be focusing on one particular point in the foreground, like we are tonight. So the king is coming, but verse 4, you can see the reality of their situation, what they wake up to every morning, though they're expecting the appearance of the king at some time, the sense of excitement about the coming kingdom is there. At the same time, look at the end of the verse 4, it's the Philistines who rule over Israel. That's their day-to-day experience of who's giving the orders, who seems to be in charge, who seems to have power. It's the Philistines, isn't it? Although we know that there's only one king, there's only one Lord, there's only one God, and it's not the Philistines. And the king is about to appear and show that truth to them. What was one of the purposes of the king? Why did they need a king? What was the thing that they've been suffering with so long through the course of the book of Judges? These enemies that keep appearing, and they have to keep finding somebody who will rise up and lead them into battle and defeat their enemies. What they need, a king who's always there, and that's his job, and that's his work, to lead the armies of the Lord into victory time and time and time again. But in the absence of a king, look in chapter 13, verse 6, which is what we looked at last week with Daniel, chapter 13 and verse 6, we can see what God is calling Samson to do until he comes. In verse 6, why do I always do this? I always write down the reference wrong somewhere. Where does it say, and he was to begin? No, to begin to... End of verse 5. Thank you so much. There we are. Thank you. Right. No razor shall come upon his head, for the child should be a Nazarite. This is Samson. To God from the womb, he shall begin to save Israel from the hand of the Philistines. You can be sure that when the king comes, he's going to finish it. And that's precisely what David did, isn't it? David the king finished the Philistines. But Samson, while he waits for the king to appear, get out there and start it. Okay? Can you see what he's called to do? He's get out there. The days are dark. The king is coming. Get out there and start it. You get the picture? All right. So, how are we going to await appearing of our Lord? How are we going to await the appearance of the king? And what we're going to read here, what we are called to do, might seem a little bit puzzling, it might seem a bit of a riddle, but hopefully as we press through, it's going to become clearer. Let's go down into our passage. Where is he? He's there, isn't he? Chapter 14, Samson is told to go down to Timnah. He's living in a little town called Zorah. And in a lot of ways, where he was living was a very safe place to live. The Philistines were in control, but his little town was right on the border. Behind him was all the mountains, and the mountains are quite difficult to attack people who live in the mountains because they're like a natural fortress. And right in front of him is all the plains, the flatlands, the best of the land where you can grow vines and wheat and barley and rich things. And all in front of him on the plains, that's where the Philistines are. They've occupied the plains. All the best land is theirs. Behind them is the rocky, hard land where the Israelites are living. And he's living right on the edge between these two. He's right on the frontier between where the Philistines are living and where the Israelites are living. He's right there. He's on the front line. And they've got a little fortress. The place which is described as his home was a little fortress on a hill with a picket around it. And it was a safe place to live. And the Philistines didn't seem to bother them. And they didn't bother the Philistines. And in one sense, they just gave their wealth to the Philistines and let them reap their harvests. And they let them carry on. And to some extent, the Philistines just let them carry on. And one of the reasons I can say that confidently is you can see when he goes down to Timnah in verse 14, chapter 14, verse 1, go down to Timnah. He doesn't have to pass an army checkpoint. He doesn't get frisked on the way out, does it? You can see it's a very relaxed thing. He could just walk down to Timnah. Timnah is a Philistine town. Well, it used to be one of the towns of Judah. but the Philistines are in there now. And it's a very open border. He could just wander in and they can wander out. Can you see that basically they're at peace with each other, these Philistines or these Israelites? The Philistines have come in and conquered. And they've just got, the Israelites have just got used to the whole situation. It's a quiet place to live. He can wander down and he can even make a proposal of marriage to one of the Philistines, can't he? He can go up there and ask his dad, please, dad, could you go down and have a word with this family down there? Maybe they'd let me marry their daughter. Everything seems to be very relaxed on this frontier town. Well, you see, you might think to yourself, well, leave well alone till the king comes, because when the king comes, he can resolve all the problems. In the meantime, we're going to sit here in our little fort, live happily and quietly. I'm going to marry, have children, start a family. Why bother until the king appears? He'll know what to do when he comes. But what we see is during the time of the Philistine ruler, this soft border that exists between the Israelites and the Philistines, it is Samson's mission, and this is what I want to talk to you about. It is Samson's mission to turn that soft, gentle, peaceable truce border into a war zone. That's his job. Now, our king is coming. And we can have a relatively peaceable, easy kind of laissez-faire arrangement with the world and with sin and the who is a Christian and who's not a Christian and the status quo of it all. And we can just get used to going to church on our Sundays and we've got our comfortable little life and our ways. And the rest of the world carries on doing what it carries on doing on its days and so on and so forth. And we can say, well, you know, that's just how it is. But Samson is being called to throw off that status quo and to make a difference and turn that peace into a conflict zone. And we'll see how he goes about doing that. He's called to start a war with the Philistines, isn't he? And the king, when he comes, he's going to finish that war once and for all. Why? Why is he called to start this war? Why upset the peace? Why upset the status quo? Because the land belongs to his people. It's the gift of Almighty God. The land that the Philistines are in, that is Judah's land, not the Philistines. And out of a love for God and a zeal for his house, he's going to get it back. And that's what God's calling him to do. Even though the king hasn't appeared yet, he's not waiting. He's going forward and he's starting it. Can you see that? Can you see? He's making a start. Chapter 13, verse 25. This isn't just because he... So, you know, some people just love fighting, don't they? You meet people, they're just trouble, right? Some people... I've told you many times, I had a friend. I used to go out with him, stuff like that, when I was a teenager. Everywhere I went, I got into trouble when I was with this guy. He had trouble with him all the time. Don't think like... Don't think Samson's. He is not a troublemaker. Chapter 13 and verse 25 tells us who is stirring Samson up. Who's putting this desire, this passion in his life? Who's giving him this vision and this determination what to do? What's it say there? And the Spirit of the Lord. He's as happy as anybody to have a peaceful, quiet life. Well, I trust you're all peaceful, quiet people. You want to have a quiet life. And yet the Lord by his Spirit stirs us up and he will not let us just rest with it. There's work to do. We've got to get out and we've got to start this thing. And that means crossing the border as we see Samson doing. It's interesting the language there. And the Spirit of the Lord stirred him up. You know that language there? That's the same language found in the New Testament. We read about Jesus being driven out into the wilderness, into the enemy territory. Who's he going to meet? Who's Jesus going to meet out in the world? He's going to meet the devil face to face on his turf. And Samson is being stirred up by God to go into enemy territory to meet the enemy face to face on their turf. He's not waiting for them to come to him. He is going to them in the power of the Lord. He's been stirred up. He's going to attack. He's on the attack. He's on the offensive. He's on the front foot. Samson is going forward. You know, we saw the reference there to the vineyards. Did you notice that reference to the vineyards? This is a beautiful part of the country. I've been there. It's an absolutely lovely. It's a rich, fertile place. Vines grow. And here is Samson with vineyards and the best of the wine. You know, he could sit there drinking, having eaten raisin cakes and enjoying himself all the day long in his little fortress up there. But he doesn't, does he? He doesn't. Samson, do you know his name means? His name means like the sun. Shemesh, the sun. He is like the dawn of something, of a change, of a difference. He's called to rise up, not sit down and drink wine. He's got to put that aside. He's got to get up and he's got to go down to the Philistines and he's going to shake it up. He's going to make a difference with his life. He's not going to sit put. He's going to make a difference. His life is going to count for the kingdom. He's not sitting back. He's going forwards. Now, we all know that Samson is very much a man. We do like to emphasize that he was just a man and some of his weaknesses. But let me tell you, you can see by his actions, God was with that man. Wasn't he? God's power was made available to that weak man. Kind of interesting, isn't it? As soon as he gets into the land, what's he meet first? Now, I like lions. Don't get me wrong. I don't want to get rid of lions. I like, you know, in their proper place at the proper time. But I think if you're living there and then, and you come across a lion, that's not, you don't want to meet a lion, do you? And that's the first thing he meets. In the land of Judah, he meets a lion. A lion of the tribe of Judah. That belongs to them, right? Right there. It's the first encounter as soon as he crossed the border. And there is that creature. And the first meal he has, he gets out from its side later. It's honey. It's like God. He's meeting the lion of the tribe of Judah, and he is taking honey. This is the land of milk and honey, isn't it? He's already tasting the promise. He's crossed the line. He's getting out there, and he's meeting things that make him think of God. Do you see what I mean? He's been encouraged. The Lord is encouraging. The Lord is giving him power and strength, enabling him to do things. He's crossed the line into the Philistine territory. That's where he's weakest, but God is showing up for him as he goes. I love my comforts, but there is a greater comfort when you go in the name of the Lord to do his will and you meet the Lord as you do it. That is a great comfort, the greatest of comforts. The encouragement of being about his business and him encouraging you in it. And it's wonderful, isn't it? This honey that he's taking out the side, there's enough for him and it gives him strength, and there's enough for his mum and there's enough for his dad out the side of the lion of Judah. There is sweet strength for God's people. Good news. The fallen lion of Judah, smitten by God, because it was through God's power that animal was brought low, isn't it? And yet out of it comes this sweetness and strength, and also the source of the riddle that he later tells. All I'm trying to say is, here's somebody who crosses the line. He gets up, he goes out, and he finds that the Lord is good. He is tasting and he is seeing that the Lord is good when he goes in faith. He doesn't stay home, but he obeys the Lord and goes out to start this thing, to start this fight. Israel has been living in defeat for a long time. But out of the dead carcass of Israel, there's a victory, this first victory. So what we're seeing, I suppose I'm put it like this, is that God alone can bring good out of evil. And Israel has failed in every sense, shape, and form. But in their failure, out of their failure, God is starting to work again. There is good coming out of evil, and we see that at work here. What am I trying to say? It's my first point. My second two points are much briefer, and I know it's late. Be patient with me, I pray. The first point I'm making is this. It's easy for us to settle into the status quo, to relax into a kind of comfortable relationship with sin and the devil and the flesh. We have to get up, and we have to face these things. We have to face them. It is better to fight and die than it is not to fight at all. Why? Because the king is coming. The king is coming. And so there can be no truce with the devil. And I think that's the first thing that I really find coming out for me as I read this, how he breaks the truce. He's breaking the truce, the deadlock. We've got to do that. So Timnah, second point, Timnah. And this daughter of the Philistines. What a strange way to begin. What a strange way. If he's got to start this process of freeing Israel, nobody seems to think that going down to Timnah and taking one of the daughters of the Philistines is a good idea. Right? It's puzzling everybody. His mum and his dad don't think it's a good idea, do they? When you obey the Lord, let me tell you, there will be strong and many voices that will say to you, this is not a good idea. Because as you go in faith in God, you get weaker, you become more vulnerable, but God's strength potentially becomes more real in your life. So what do his mother and father say? They say, well, look, why don't you settle down? You meet a local girl. There must be a pretty girl somewhere around here in the tribe of Dan. You could settle down, have a family. She cooks like the kind of how you like it, and everything's going to be fine. No. No. I'm going down to Timnah. I want a daughter of the Philistines, a foreigner, a stranger. The same voice comes to us, doesn't it? When the lion came out, what would you naturally want to do if a lion came out roaring at you? What voice is going to be in your head? Run! No. No running. We're not running. We're standing and we're fighting. And when he was growing up all in this rich wine-growing region, how many times did somebody pass the glass of wine under his nose? How many times was there a raisin cake offered to him? He's a Nazarite. How many times did he have to say, no, thank you, no, thank you, no, thank you, no, thank you, no, thank you? You know, a Christian has to learn to say no. No. Not yes. We have to learn to say no. When his hair grows out, he had to have this long hair, didn't he? And this is a hot country. His head must have been getting hot. His hair's going down in his face and in his whatever. And to be honest with you, in those days, we know that in the Bible it says for a man to have long hair, it's a shame to him. It wasn't a particularly honorable thing. In other words, in some ways, he looked like a girl. That's not a bad thing, by the way. There must be so many temptations to go and get a haircut like the other kids, to tidy himself up, to have a bit more of a macho haircut. I'm not saying anything. He looks weak. But those temptations, he's saying, no, no, I'm trusting the Lord. He's my strength. He's my food. He's my drink. See, self-denial, that's what we've got to do. Self-denial, we've got to deny ourselves. We've got to take up our cross. We are consecrated to the living God. We've been bought with a price. We belong to him. And there's a voice in the world, a voice of reason that says this is all a very, very bad idea. But God is speaking, and he stirs up his people by the Spirit. And we leave Zorah and our little fort, and we head off into enemy territory in weakness, but in dependence on the power of Almighty God. And that's where we meet him. That's where we meet him. So no to the status quo. No to some kind of a compromise with our sin. No, 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 and yes to the spiritual conflict, spiritual warfare. Yes to that. Because that's where he's been led. Jesus went out into the wilderness to go and encounter and wrestle and overcome the temptations of the devil. We have to overcome in his strength. Why does Samson want one of the daughters of the Philistines? Who in this room thinks it's because she was just so pretty? Who in this room thinks it's because he actually believed that she could make him happy and she was a fitting wife for him? I don't think that's the case at all. I'm going to cut against some of the commentaries on this point. The reason he wanted to marry the daughter of the Philistine, because he knew what she was like. He knew that she would betray him. And what he needed more than anything was an excuse and the opportunity to start a fight. But they had to make the first bad move. And she was perfect. She's the one who will do this job. She is his Judas. Jesus had to be betrayed, had to make himself weak, had to fall into the hands of the enemy, had to let them overplay their hands. And in the overplaying of their hand, the power of God at work. I love that verse that said, if they had known, if the powers at work had known that God would raise the Lord Jesus from the dead, they would have never crucified him. And the Philistines, if they had known the mistake they were making in thinking, oh, when the wedding feast comes, oh, we'll get 30 more blokes along. They think they're going to bleed this guy dry. They're never going to give this woman to him. They are not at peace with him. They think they're superior to him. And he is going into the eye of the storm, entering in. I don't think he thought for a minute. What's it say in the Bible? What's it actually say here? Verse 4, it was the Lord. God was telling him to go down to Timnah to take this woman as his bride. Does God sanctify marrying out? In the Old Testament, are Israelites allowed to marry those who are not the people of Israel? No. Are we in our day called to unequally yoke ourselves to unbelievers? No. So God is commanding him and leading him into this act, not because that act in and itself is his will for his life in that sense. No, we're told categorically in verse 4, because he, that is God, was seeking an opportunity to open up a front, to open up an offense, to start the battle that should never have been stopped. When it says he was seeking an opportunity, who do you believe that refers to? God. But it's got a little H. So the translators are saying it's Samson. Do you know, I don't think there's any difference. It's God, it's Samson, it's God, it's Samson. They both agree this is what has to be done. If we're going to start this fight, this is where it starts. Samson was just a man. Samson was just a man seeking an opportunity how he might serve the Lord. And as he went in obedience to do it, what did he find? Well, the lion found out quite soon that the Lord was with him. And the 30 Philistines in Ashkelon with all their nice clothes found out quite soon that the Lord was with him. You know, sometimes I think we're concerned, aren't we, what will happen if we obey the Lord? This morning, Daniel and I were praying, and that verse came to mind. You know, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil. And I know that's a great encouragement to not fear death, because death is a real enemy to us. But if we don't have to fear death, what should we fear? What should we be afraid of? I mean, that's the worst thing. If we don't need to fear the worst that can happen, why should we fear these other things? Why should we fear? Why are we afraid? Samson is not afraid. Jesus is not afraid. Don't be afraid. Fear not, as the angel repeatedly says. And as he goes, without fear, the Philistines find out who they need to be afraid of, and the lion finds out who they need to be afraid of. Everybody needs to be afraid of God, because he's the one with the power. So go in his strength. Her betrayal is not something to be afraid of. It's his perfect opportunity. It's his Judas, as I said. There are so many parallels here with Christ and his cross. The way they're born, the birth of Samuel, the birth of Samson, the birth of Jesus, the power of the Spirit at work in Samson, the power of the Spirit at work in Samuel, the power of the Spirit at work in Jesus, the betrayal in Samson, the betrayal in Jesus. It's interesting, as the last passage in chapter 13, as the parents meet the Spirit, the angel of the Lord, and they're astonished that they've survived this experience. We've seen God and we've lived. How can that be? There's only one of the three persons of the Trinity who you can see and meet and hear the voice of and live. And that's the second person of the Trinity. You can meet Christ and live. And you've seen God. If you've seen Christ, you can see God and live. That's who they saw. Jesus was present, as it were, at his birth. When the angel of the Lord, he literally ascends. There's only one other person apart from Elijah who ascends into heaven. It's like the presence of Jesus is right over his life. Is the presence of Jesus over yours? Is that sense of Jesus present in what you do and how you live, in the things that give you strength? Is it clear in your choices, in the no's that you make and the yeses that you make, that Jesus is at work in your life? Because it seems to me that he was very much at work in the life of Samson. Have you got a zeal for his house? Oh, his behavior is a bit of a riddle. People don't necessarily understand how a Christian lives, the choices we make, and why we insist on making ourselves vulnerable, going off to Brazil and places like that. Why? Because of God. Because of God. And we need to reactivate the border. If it's got quiet, it's got easy, and got comfortable, we need to stir it up. Stir it up. That's what Jesus did. At the end of chapter 14, verse 19, you can see the border is no longer a peaceful border. Chapter 14 and verse 19 at the end, the Spirit of the Lord has rushed on him. He's come down. There's 30 dead bodies and a dead lion down in the land of Judah. It's not peaceful anymore. And when he goes back hot with anger to his father's house, the situation has changed. Christ is drawing us into spiritual conflict. The last point is so brief. It says in the book of Deuteronomy that one shall put 1,000 to flight, two shall put 10,000 to flight. And here we see the remarkable occurrence of one person going on their own down into enemy territory. It looks totally foolish, doesn't it? The guy is going to get ripped to shreds by lions and Philistines and all the rest. And it must make us ask, what difference can you make? One person, what difference can you make? Well, the book of Deuteronomy tells us we can make a great difference. You saying no to the world, you saying yes to God, can make a great difference. Ask the lion whether one person can make a difference. Ask the Philistines whether one person can make a difference. And perhaps you've got your testimonies. Pass the bees, whether one person can make a difference. They found a home thanks to him. It's a bit of a riddle. It's a bit of a mystery that our weakness is God's opportunity to display his strength. It's a bit of a hard one to square. And really, to be honest with you, unless I'd been told it, just like the Philistine woman told the riddle to the Philistines, unless you're told this thing, you probably would never work it out. We have to be told the gospel. We have to be told to put our trust in God and not in ourselves and lean not on our own understanding. And we have to be told these things. If we do what we're told and head off into enemy territory, even though we might look young and girlish and misunderstood or whatever it is, God's strength will be displayed. That is our confidence. So what I'm saying to you as I close, go to Timnah. Go down to Timnah. Every single one of you, go down to Timnah. If you haven't been there, go and cause some trouble in Timnah. And watch the predator turn to prey. Watch the oppressor being oppressed. You can't work this out in your head. You have to be just told, and you have to just do it. And see what the Lord will do. The whole of Christianity is offensive. Galatians chapter 5 verse 11 speaks of the offense of the cross. It's offensive. The word there for offense in the Greek, scandalos. It's a scandal. It causes people to stumble. It upsets people. make sure it's the right people that are being upset and scandalized by the offense of the cross. The king is coming. Don't just sit there. Get up, go to Timnah, claim what's yours, because when the king comes, and this is my final line, but one, when the king comes, where are you going to be found? In the fort? With a glass of Chablis? Or in the battle? Is that where he's going to find you when the day comes? In the battle? It's not a nice place to be, but it's the right place to be. Will he find faith when he comes? Let's meet him in the battle.